So we're continuing, just for a little brief moment, the rest of the journey through the first 25 chapters. We're up to 22, as you can see, and I'll just read you some selections from that. And this section is about God's judgment with hints of hope, because there are always hints of hope because God is God. So when there's never despair appropriate, because God's faithfulness is always there to be accessed. So, woe to him who builds his house by unrighteousness, his upper rooms by injustice, who makes his neighbours work for nothing and doesn't give them their wages, who says, I'll build myself a spacious house with large upper rooms. Windows will be set in it. It will be panelled with cedar, painted with vermilion. He's talking to King Jehoiakim. Are you, O king, a king because you compete in cedar? Did not your father, and that's the great King Josiah, did not your father eat and drink and do justice and righteousness? He prospered. He judged the cause of the poor and needy, and he prospered. Is not this to know me, says Yahweh? If you say you know me, knowing me means doing justice and righteousness and looking after the rights of the poor and the needy. It's a beautiful definition of Yahweh. There probably isn't a better one around, but that's it from Jeremiah. Woe to the shepherds who lead astray and scatter the sheep of my pasture, says Yahweh. Therefore, thus says Yahweh, the God of Israel, to the shepherds who shepherd my people, it's you who've scattered my flock and driven them away. You've not attended to them. So I will attend to you for your evil doings, says Yahweh. Then I myself will gather the remnant of my flock out of all the lands where I have driven them, and I'll bring them back to their fold, and they will be fruitful and multiply, and I will raise up shepherds over them who will shepherd them, and they shall not fear any longer or be dismayed, nor will any be missing, says Yahweh. The days are surely coming, says Yahweh, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch of the house, and he shall reign as king and deal wisely, and shall execute justice and righteousness in the land. In his days Judah will be saved, and Israel will live in safety, and this is the name by which he will be called: Yahweh is our righteousness. Jeremiah still looked as God has promised, so they believed. David, his dynasty would last forever, so he's naturally looking forward to someone from the house of David who would actually do it properly. It didn't happen. Well, it did happen. From the Christian perspective, they saw Jesus as the fulfillment of this. But you can't see that in that text. So you've got to go backwards to see the fulfillment. So fulfillment is always, it's through belonging to Jesus that we can read the Old Testament through his eyes and through the eyes of those who loved him. But if you just come from the Old Testament view without considering Jesus, well, you end up crucifying him, because it doesn't compute. It doesn't necessarily, the dots aren't joined except looking backwards. But that's how we are as human beings anyhow. Our life experience opens us up to see the connections. Do not listen to the words of the prophets who prophesy to you. They're deluding you. They speak visions of their own, not from the mouth of Yahweh. They keep saying to those who despise the word of Yahweh, it shall be well with you. And to all who stubbornly follow their own stubborn hearts, they say, no calamity shall come upon you. Who has stood in the counsel of Yahweh so as to see and hear his word? Who has given heed to his word so as to proclaim it? I did not send the prophets, yet they ran. I didn't speak to them, yet they prophesied. But if they had stood in my counsel, then they would have proclaimed my words to my people, turning them from their wicked ways and their evil deeds." What a powerful passage, isn't it? Requiring of all those who speak for God that they listen first. And here's a lovely statement that the rabbis used to love this one. You know, going back in the early centuries of the AD. "Is not my word like fire, says Yahweh? It's like a hammer that breaks a rock in pieces." The rabbis, their aim was to get 1,000 meanings out of a text. In modern scholarship, we're trying to get to understand, this is not the only thing they're doing, but they're trying to get to the text, who wrote it, and it's a good thing to try to do. You can't avoid it. You shouldn't avoid it. And when it was said, and how was it understood at the time? That's a very important thing because, well, you know, I don't have to say why. But that wasn't what the rabbis were. They couldn't do it for a start. They didn't have the means to do it. But they weren't interested in doing it because it was God's word, so it was full of 1,000 meanings. So they'd like smash it open and phew, sparks would fly everywhere. And they think, oh, because it's God's word. It's infinite. Are you following the feeling of it? So they're looking for as many meanings as they can, which we still do when we come in a little prayer group. And it's a good thing to do. You come into a prayer group and someone says, "Oh, when I read that, this is what I think," and you know, and then someone says, "Oh, that's," because what you're doing is you're revealing your response, which is a lovely thing to do in a community of love that you belong in this prayer group. A good thing to do. What's not good to do is to take two more steps. One of them is, "This is what Luke means." You can't do that. You can say what you feel when you listen to Luke, and that's a grace to give. But if you say it's what Luke means, you've got to do your study. There's no choice. And don't go the next step and say, "This is what God says." So those two statements, the first one requires scholarship and the third one requires humility not to say it. But you're doing your best to. So there's the text. "Is not my word like a fire, like a hammer that shatters the rocks and sparks of flint." And another beautiful stage, and then I finish here with the first 25 chapters. "I will give them a heart to know." It's beautiful. Someone said earlier, talking about the intellectual, you know, the mind. You were, John, I think. So no, it's the heart that knows. So to have an interior that knows that I am Yahweh. "They shall be my people. I will be their God. They will come back to me with all their heart." So that's the conclusion that I'm giving you of the first 25 chapters of the Jeremiah material. Just to briefly look at this, the next section is a few verses of chapter 25, then it's followed by chapters, and this is too complicated to go into clearly, but the Septuagint has a completely different order. That's the Greek Bible, puts all these from 46 to 51 in the Hebrew Bible, and therefore in your translations, it puts them here, and this is the right place to have them. Whoever shifted them to the end, I'll talk about that another time, or I won't talk about it at all, unless you want me to. So this is the order of the texts as in the Septuagint, and they got it right. And it's, and I'm not going to do any of it all. Oracles against the nations. Now, Jeremiah would have spoken out against Egypt, maybe, probably. He would have spoken out against Babylon. He might have done some of the others. But these texts seem to be applied to different ones as the people became problematic. So this is presumed to be, or no, it isn't presumed to be. A lot of scholars would say this is post-Jeremiah. But there it is. Speaking out against, I'll run through the list, Egypt, Philistia, Moab, Ammon, Edom, Aram, Kedar, that's Saudi Arabia, Elam and Babylon. And the point being made is that God isn't just picking on Judah. He's also the God of all nations. And the criticisms that in Jeremiah's name, whether by Jeremiah or by people later, it's pretty difficult to discern, he's looking at those. Then the next section, chapters 26 to 45, is history, basically. And stories about Jeremiah, the life and times, and it takes up a third of the scroll. I'll just select a very few little bits from this. This one is about a letter that Jeremiah wrote from Jerusalem, where he stayed, after the exile, the beginning of the exile. So it's after 597, when the king and the leaders and the military generals and everyone who's everybody was carted off into exile. Jeremiah was left at home, and he writes a letter to these people living in exile. And it's quite lovely, really, and I'll just let it speak for itself. Thus says Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles whom I've sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. And this is his advice to them. Build your houses, live in them, plant gardens and eat what they produce. Take wives, have sons and daughters, take wives for your sons and give, in other words, live. Stop moping around and sitting there thinking, oh, we're not in Jerusalem anymore. Get in there, build up the banks. If you go to the eastern suburbs of Sydney, take it over. Like he's telling them to get into the life of Babylon while they're there, which is pretty sound advice. I'll keep going. Give your daughters in marriage that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there. Don't decrease. Seek, this is good, seek the welfare of the city where I've sent you into exile. So if you're a Muslim and you've come to Australia to get away from something, for God's sake, get into the country, but seek the welfare of that country. Stop trying to bring in your own Sharia law and that suit you. And no, if you come into a country and you want to be a citizen of that country, of course you critique it like everybody else, but you've got to welcome that country and you've got to admit that the government has some kind of authority, you've got to accept it, and you've got to commit yourself to what the country's on about. Become part of it. The way the Dutch did when they came to Australia, perfect. We've never had better migrants. They just come in, you wouldn't know. But, you know, others too, they've come into our country and they've belonged and contributed. That's what he's telling them to do. It's good advice, I think, but it's not necessarily what you'd think of doing. If you were a Jew, and then you might stick with your Jews and in your little suburb of Babylon and kind of resent and mope. Okay. Seek the welfare of the city where I've sent you and pray to Yahweh on its behalf. This is big-minded stuff, this is. For its welfare, you will find your welfare. Thus says Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, don't let the prophets and the diviners who are among you deceive you. They did before, don't let them keep doing it. Don't listen to the dreams that they're dreaming. It's a lie they're prophesying to you in my name. I didn't send them, says Jeremiah. Well, the others wouldn't agree with that. But it looks like Jeremiah was right, because they kept Jeremiah and we haven't kept the others. Thus says Yahweh, only when Babylon's 70 years are completed will I visit you. So was this written with prescience, a bit of foresight? 70 sounds a bit, it's a pretty good number, 7, you know, 70. But it was about that they were there. So this became a little number that they like to argue about, and we'll see it in later prophets. Or was this put in afterwards, when someone updated Jeremiah and said, why not? There's nothing wrong with that. Only when Babylon 70 years are completed will I visit you, and I will fulfill to you my promise. I'll bring you back to this place. Surely I know the plans I have for you, says Yahweh. Plans for your welfare, not your harm, to give you a future filled with hope. Then when you call on me and come and pray to me, I'll hear you. When you search for me, you'll find me. If you seek me with all your heart, I'll let you find me, says Yahweh. And I'll restore your fortunes and gather you from all the nations and all the places where I've driven you, says Yahweh, and I'll bring you back to the place from which I sent you into exile. That's chapter 29. It's lovely. Hope you enjoy it. Now, chapter 30 and 31 is beautiful stuff. It stands out. It's like a little unit on its own. And if you didn't know any better, you'd look at it and you'd think, see, it's very like what we call Second Isaiah, but that's not such a good term. The group of people who wrote that section of Isaiah from chapter 40 through to 55, and then their disciples back in Judah who finished off the scroll. And it's about new creation, it's about covenant, it's full of hope stuff. As far as I can tell, and it's an infinite journey in a way, I think it's written by what we'd call the temple singers. The same people who wrote the Psalms wrote that part of Isaiah. Because they're not in the temple. The temple's back in Jerusalem. They've got nothing to do. But they're poets and they're singers, and the style is so similar. Well, my hypothesis is that this was written by the same group of people who wrote that part of the Isaiah scroll. And I'm calling them temple singers. What about the author? Let's listen to the content. "Have no fear, my servant Jacob," says Yahweh. "Don't be dismayed, O Israel. I'm going to save you from far away and your offspring from the land of their captivity. Jacob shall return and have quiet and ease, and no one will make him afraid. For I am with you, says Yahweh, to save you. I'll make an end to all the nations among which I scattered you, but of you I will not make an end. I will chastise you in just measure, and I'll by no means leave you unpunished. Thus says Yahweh, I'm going to restore the fortunes of the tents of Jacob. I will have compassion on his dwellings. The city will be rebuilt about its mound, and the citadel set on its rightful site. Out of them shall come thanksgiving and the sound of merrymakers. Their prince shall be one of their own. Their ruler shall come from their midst. I'll bring him near and he'll approach me. Who would otherwise dare to approach me, says Yahweh? And you will be my people and I will be your God." Well, it's beautiful and it's a promise, and there's something really at the heart of it all. It didn't actually work out quite like that, because they are under Persia for whatever year, 250 years something. Then they're under the Greeks, and then they're under the Romans, and then they got banished. But the dream was there, and it's saying something about God's desire in here or whatever. 31 continues, the same material, same kind of material, and this will be the completion of our morning together. This will all be on chapter 31. Excuse me. "Thus says Yahweh, sing aloud with gladness for Jacob." I'm sure if you just read this somewhere, you'd think it came out of 2 Isaiah. Do you get me? It's the same style of song, psalm. "Thus says Yahweh, sing aloud with gladness for Jacob. Raise shouts for the chief of the nations. Proclaim, give praise and say, Yahweh has saved Israel, saved his people, the remnant of Israel. See, I'm going to bring them from the land of the north." That's the people who were exiled back in 721 from Israel, from the northern kingdom. "I will gather them from the farthest parts of the earth." And no doubt when the Jews went back in, was it 1948, was it? When they went back to Israel for the first time, they must have felt a lot of this being fulfilled, understandably. "And gather them from the furthest parts of the earth, among them the blind and the lame, those with child and those in labour. A great company, they shall return here. With weeping they will come, with consolations I will lead them back. I will let them walk by brooks of water on a level road in which they shall not stumble. For I have been a father to Israel. Ephraim is my firstborn. Hear the word of Yahweh, O nations. Declare to the distant coastlands, he who scattered Israel will gather him and will keep him as a shepherd tends his flock. Thus says Yahweh," a voice, this is quoted by Matthew, "a voice is heard in Ramah." Now Ramah is a little north of Jerusalem, and that's where the exiles were herded together, and from there they went up along the river, and then down into exile into Babylon. So Ramah is not Auschwitz, it's not as bad as that, but it's the place where they are in camp, ready to be transported into exile. So very beautifully, a voice is heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel's the wife of Jacob. So this is the mother of all the tribes. That's why she's noted. Rachel is weeping for her children. So he's imagining this, the whole country weeping. It's every mother is weeping. She refused to be comforted because they are no more. And that's quoted by Matthew when he has that scene of Bethlehem and the little children being the holy innocents. Historical, wouldn't have a clue, doubt it. But it's telling us something about the persecution of the church and so on, and the weeping that's going on. Still, chapter 31, is Ephraim my dear son? Is he the child I delight in? As often as I speak against him, says God, I still remember him. I'm deeply moved for him. I will surely have mercy on him, says Yahweh. And then a great promise, which is picked up in the letter to the Hebrews and Christians, the Christian Jews. The Jews who became Christians saw this as being fulfilled in their community, and rightly so. The days are surely coming, says Yahweh, when I'll make a new covenant. That's the Last Supper. The new covenant in my blood, Jesus says, with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant that I made with their ancestors, when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, the big story, a covenant that they broke, though I was their Lord. This is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says Yahweh. I will put my law within them. I'll write it on their hearts. And I will be their God, and they will be my people. So it'll be written on their hearts. It won't be imposed from outside. It'll be, and that's why we've got to listen to our heart. No longer will they teach one another or say to each other, know Yahweh. They shall all know me, from the least to the greatest, says Yahweh. I will forgive their iniquity. I will remember their sin no more. Then comes the third section of Jeremiah, section chapter 32 to 33, about nothing being impossible for Yahweh. Then 34 to 35, Israel must learn to listen. And then 36 to 45 is the history of the fall of Jerusalem, and it ends up with Jeremiah being carted off against his will. And it goes on to that section after the destruction of the temple, when Gedaliah was in charge, and when he was assassinated by one of the princes of the house. So there was all this internal stuff. Then they carted Jeremiah off to Egypt, and we don't know what happened there. There's one story that he was martyred there, and there's another story, legend, that he died there as an old man full of years.